Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Our topic today, pornography.
Well, Ken, the first thing we should probably do with a topic like pornography is define our terms. We should define pornography.
Well, John, but remember the late Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart? He was famous for having said that he couldn't define pornography, but that he knew it when he saw it. I'm not sure we can do any better here.
Well, he's famous for saying that, but it never made much sense to me. Because why can't he just tell us what it is he sees when he sees pornography? And it seems to me you could. You'd say pornography is the graphic depiction or descriptions of intimate sexual acts with an intense focus on sexual organs for the express purpose of causing sexual arousal in the viewer, listener, or, in some cases, reader.
That seems too broad, John. That definition would make things that are romantic, artistic, and erotic count as something base and pornographic.
Well, some of them, perhaps. Not a lot of them. But it seems to me you're making a pretty common but mistaken assumption that pornography should, by definition, be a bad thing.
Well, pornography is a bad thing, John. It debases and objectifies women. It promotes the sexual exploitation of children. It glorifies sexual violence.
No doubt some pornography is bad, and just in the ways you say. But how can you claim that pornography is bad by definition?
Are you suggesting that we should try to define pornography in value-neutral terms, not in value-laden terms?
Exactly right. I don't think we should try to settle the moral issues about pornography by loading up what should be a descriptive definition with value-laden terms. We have to look at how pornography actually works, at its social, psychological, and economic effects in the real world.
You know, I really would like to trump your claim there with the authority of a good dictionary. But, you know, if you look to the dictionary, what you find is disagreement about this thing. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary defines pornography as the depiction of erotic behavior, as in pictures or writing, intended to cause sexual excitement. That's a value-neutral definition. But at dictionary.com, you find a more value-laden definition. Obscene writings, drawings, photographs, or the like, especially those having little or no artistic merit.
Well, between those two definitions, I prefer the Merriam-Webster one because it is more value-neutral. But I actually like mine better because theirs is pretty broad. I mean, a lot of depictions of erotic behavior seem to be not to be pornographic. But however we want to define pornography, we'd still have the same problem. The real question is, which depictions of sex organs and sex acts are morally problematic and which are not? If you want to build being morally problematic into the definition of pornography, you'll need another term to describe the things that are just graphically explicit. What distinguishes the problematic ones from the ones that aren't?
Well, I'll tell you what distinguishes the problematic ones. They're the ones that debase and objectify women, that exploit children, that promote sexual violence, all the things I was saying before.
Let's set aside child pornography. I don't think that has any defenders, at least not in the philosophical literature. But are you suggesting that certain representations of sexual acts are intrinsically morally problematic?
That is what I'm suggesting. I mean, there's just something plain distasteful about pictures of naked women in bondage. I mean, don't you agree?
Well, tastes vary. Some people like that sort of thing, obviously. Some people like to see pictures of naked men in bondage. Many of us don't really get turned on by that. But we're not discussing matters of taste. We want to discuss matters of morality.
Well, I think we are discussing matters of morality. There's something intrinsically morally wrong with representations of women in sexual bondage. Anybody ought to find such representations distasteful. Now, you know, I might not call someone who likes that sort of thing evil, but, I would call them perverted. And I think that's a term of moral condemnation, perversion.
Well, I think you're a prude. I mean, one person's perversion is another person's supreme erotic pleasure. Some people can't handle explicit sexual representations. Some people can't handle explicit violence. That's why the movies have a rating system. So just to keep pornography out of the hands of people who can't handle it, we need a rating system. But otherwise, leave it alone.
And you're a liberal. Well, but you know, there's a lot to talk about here. And to help us sort through this thicket of issues, we'll be joined in a bit by Ray Langton. She's the author of Sexual Solipsism, Philosophical Essays on Pornography and Objectification.
And we'd like our listeners to join in the discussion. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Molly Samuel, visits a place where pornography is hardly a dirty word.
San Francisco's old armory is a 3 or 4 story brick behemoth on an otherwise normal corner in the Mission District. The National Guard was stationed at the armory until the 1970s, but it's a little different now.
So this is the bondage storage room, wall of whips and chains and leather straps and paddles and stocks and all kinds of crazy things.
John Sander is the vice president of marketing at kink.com. The company produces hardcore pornography for its more than 20 fetish websites, sites like Water Bondage and Naked Combat. Before Kink moved into the old armory, they spent a lot of money creating sets that looked how this building looks already. Now they can exploit the armory's creepy, dank, abandoned feel.
Yeah, this is a stockade where they actually used to keep the bad soldiers. And it's obviously great for what we do today.
Sander says he's proud of what he does.
I actually turned the job down a couple times. I wasn't ready to have that on my resume, but at the end of the day, it's a great company. I respect the company. It's a very ethical company.
It's a busy place, kink.com. About 100 people are on staff, not including actors who are all independent contractors.
What are you guys shooting today? What?
Prop designers and set builders bustle around the building while video editors and web developers sit in dimmed rooms in front of rows of computer monitors.
It's an interesting place, but it's definitely not the flesh fest that I think a lot of people think about when they think about working for a porn company.
Technology director Stacia Carr keeps the building and the computers running.
Particularly working in technology, it's a lot of problem solving that you would do in any other job. The scale of it is sometimes a lot larger. But beyond that, it's just a lot of work.
The employees at Kink shoot and produce about 5 new videos a day. And marketing director John Sander says they get a lot of web traffic. Just how much?
A lot. I mean, millions and millions of people look at our content every month.
Like most adult entertainment companies, Kink.com is privately owned, so their profits aren't public information. In this industry, those numbers are murky across the board. And in consumer surveys, people aren't always totally honest about how much time or money they spend on pornography. An estimate of about $10 billion in profits for the entire industry has been tossed around. That's including websites, video rentals, and strip clubs. One thing Sander will say, though, is that the business has changed.
Probably a lot of the mystique around the adult industry is in the past. It used to be the wild, wild west on the internet. Just not the case anymore. There's a lot of competition and there's a lot of free content that you're competing with, similar to the situation with newspapers.
Still, there are some things that will probably never change. Tech director Stacia Carr.
In terms of job experiences, getting started here is probably one of the most unique experiences you'll ever have, because while it is not particularly exciting once you've been here for a while, you do run into naked models in the middle of the building walking from, you know, the kitchen back to your office. This does not happen in your regular corporate or even technology culture.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Molly Samuel.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Rae Langton. She's a professor of philosophy from MIT. She's author of Sexual Solipsism, Philosophical Essays on Pornography and Objectification. Rae, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Rae, pornography is, I guess, an intrinsically interesting subject. And you know, any thinking citizen these days would wonder about it and be gripped by what's going on. But is there anything special that we as philosophers bring to the discussion?
Well, you and Ken have already been bringing one thing to the discussion, which is the question of whether definitions matter and whether definitions need to be value neutral or whether they ought to capture a pejorative reading or what. So I think it's pretty clear that the minute you start looking at the way we use these words, whether pornography, obscenity, you can't just throw up your hands like the judge who said, "I know it when I see it." We can do more. And one way that I got interested in this was actually because of the issue of definitions.
So give us your own working definition of pornography.
Well, I don't know if I have one of my own. You know, in a way, I'm quite happy to work with whatever definition you start with. But then I completely agree with what John said when he said that if you decide to define pornography in terms of sexually explicit material that's designed to arouse, so you've got the explicit part and the purpose or function part of the definition, that's value neutral, but then our interest will be in a subset of that material, and we'll ask, okay, let's suppose that there's some material that satisfies that general definition. Let's turn our attention to the material that Ken is interested in when he says that it's that it's objectifying and that it expresses perverse tastes. And anyway, there are lots of different things right. that he said, by the way.
Right. I want to ask you, you started to mention in passing how you got interested in this subject. There's something about...
Right.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay, so there was a famous legal definition of pornography, which was drafted by Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, which was very different to the down-to-earth definition that... that John was mentioning. So MacKinnon famously defined pornography as the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of women in pictures or words that also includes women dehumanized as sexual objects, things or commodities, enjoying pain or humiliation or rape. And then the definition goes on for quite a lot longer, specifying the content that would be typical for pornography as she was defining it. Now, the legislation famously made pornography a civil rights violation against women. So clearly what it's doing is turning attention to what would be a subset of the pornography that John was thinking about and saying, look, we are going to call this subset pornography and we're going to define it as a civil rights violation, as subordination of women. There were interesting questions about why it didn't go through the legislation in question. It wasn't, by the way, a ban. It was trying to make trafficking in pornography civilly actionable rather than banning it. But what got me interested in as a philosopher was the attention that was given to the question, does pornography subordinate women? Could pornography be the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of women? Because what happened when, one thing that happened when the case went to court, obviously, was that it came up against the massive edifice of First Amendment doctrine. But another thing that happened is the judges complained that it was conceptually confused. Now, philosophers always prick up their ears when they hear a complaint about conceptual confusion, and I don't think that claim is conceptually confused at all. There's nothing confused about the idea. Okay, so the... Do you want me to say what they thought was confused?
No, we're going to hold that for our next segment because we're getting into it. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing pornography with Ray Langton, author of Sexual Solipsism, Essays on Pornography and Objectification.
Coming up, what, if anything, is bad about pornography? Is pornography intrinsically bad or bad just because of its social consequences? Is one person's perversion another's erotic pleasure? Are there objective facts about what is pornographic and what is not? Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
What's so bad about pornography? Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Pornography is the topic here on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What's wrong with seeing an old flame in a pornographic magazine? Is pornography bad in and of itself? Are there objective facts about what is pornographic and what is not? And what do you think?
Our toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. And you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Join the discussion. Our guest is Ray Langton, author of Sexual Solipsism.
So, Ray, I want to go back to this question of whether certain kinds of representations, let's not worry about the definition just right now.
Okay.
But certain kinds of sexual representations are intrinsically and morally problematic. I take it that you side with McKinnon and think certain kinds are. Do I have that right? And can you explain why you think that and what kinds are?
Okay, well, McKinnon herself would want to say that pornography is not a moral issue. She has an essay with that title. So what she is wanting to focus on and what feminists have been wanting to focus on is the idea that it's a political issue. So the analogy would be between pornography, certain sorts of pornography, let's restrict our attention, and hate speech. So, suppose pornography creates a climate where sexual violence is more likely. That isn't just a moral issue, that's a political issue, because sexual violence is part of what keeps women down. So part of the debate about pornography is going to be a political debate. And part of it, though, I do think is a moral issue. So it has to do with wider questions about what sort of life you want to live. And here's where general issues about whether you want to live a life where your sexual imagination is invaded and taken over by the scripts of the pornographers, or whether you would prefer sex to be a voyage of discovery with a real human being. These come in. And those are general moral issues which are not feminist political issues.
Ray, I think that's a great point we want to get to. But I want to get just a little bit back to definitions. I mean, it's easy to say, well, just define your terms and let's go on. But McKinnon and company, we're on to a real phenomenon. It ought to have a name. It ought to be discussed. Maybe there should be laws about it. But to use the term pornography for that particular phenomenon means that certain questions can't be raised that ought to be raised. I think there are explicit sexual depictions, things that I can't say I wouldn't want my children to see because they're all grown, but I certainly wouldn't want my grandchildren to see, that I don't think are necessarily offensive to women or represent women as objects or anything like that. They're just sexually explicit studies of organs. I regard them as pornographic. I wouldn't want my grandchildren to see them. Then there are other things that debase women, and there's an additional reason I wouldn't want my grandchildren to see them. I might not want anybody to be able to see them. But if we don't have a word why take a word that has a good descriptive content and load it up? It is, I think, the judges were right. It invites, at any rate, conceptual confusion.
I think that she had a point, and part of what she was wanting to do was to say, that thing that you call pornography in this neutral sense, I want you to think of that, or I want you to think of most of that as having political import, as being a civil rights violation. So I think she had a rhetorical point there. Myself, I would be quite happy to use a definition of pornography which was more neutral, but then we would, let's say, have a label of objectifying pornography or subordinating pornography that would be the object of our attention.
Right. I agree with your impulse. I would be willing to have a more neutral term and then focus in on the stuff that we think is morally problematic and ask why we think the stuff that we think is morally problematic is morally problematic. And I want to get to that because you talked about, I think you agree with the idea that some of these representations objectify women. And I take it objectifying means treat as a thing, right? McKinnon thinks not only treat as a thing, but somehow turn into a thing or something like that.
Let's not focus on McKinnon because I think we have actually a much clearer philosopher here to talk to. And I think you made a good distinction, but let me see if I can put it. In other words, I think there's a historical element here, too. I mean, the porn industry used to be controlled by the people who controlled it when it was basically just an industry aimed at seedy old men. Now it's turned into something quite different. But there is a subset of pornography that clearly is exploitative of women. But I think you're making a claim, or you're at least you're raising a question. How about just ordinary pornography that doesn't objectify anybody any more than anyone else, but it is just it's just a depiction of an act without emotion, without interest, without higher goals, without a relationship. Isn't that in itself objectionable? whether or not it's of this special subtype that McKinnon was interesting. Isn't that the second question you were trying to get us to focus on?
What you're asking about is now the merely explicit and arousing material.
Yeah, do we really do we,
which
do we
is
really,
not objectifying.
Yeah, do we want yeah. do we want the live do we want our lives, do we want the lives of the people we love, do we want the lives of people in general to think of sex more or less through the filter of this explicit pornography, which judging by the way that people like Jay Leno and talk about it has just become mainstream. It's not embarrassing for people to say that they look at pornography.
I think this is a great question. And it gets deeply into the heart of questions about what it takes for material to be objectifying in the first place. Because some philosophers have said, look, feminists should only be concerned with material that is whose content it's obvious that it's subordinating. So it's eroticizing hierarchy or it's legitimating violence. But you're raising the more general question about what we do with an industry Anthony Burgess once gave a different definition of pornography as a substitute sexual partner, which is a very brief and minimal and neutral one. Well, what do we do with an industry that tries to set up substitute sexual partners to the extent that the practice of having sex with these invades the personal lives of the consumers in ways that not only women testify about, but many men do too, testify about how it affects their relationships with real women, and also, by the way, how it affects their own sexual lives. I mean, one thing that's clear is that it gets them bored with sex.
Well, you know, these are interesting and tough questions, and I think we have to dig into them some more, but I also want to invite some callers into this conversation. You can join this conversation by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. We're talking about pornography with our guest Ray Langton, and we've got a caller on the line now, Brian in Menlo Park. Brian, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Oh, thank you very much. Enjoying the show. A couple comments. It seems virtually impossible to find pornography on the Internet that's not really vile and revolting and disgusting. And I remember when Playboy presented its Playmate of the Month as the girl next door. Seems to be the case not only if you're living next door to a brothel. And I wondered, I asked a woman I know who's a sex therapist why this is the case. She said, well, that's because men are afraid of women. Second comment is that with increasing freedom, liberties, pornography has become increasingly violent and degrading of women, which suggests that men have this kind of hate and fear of women. And if that's increasingly true, an increasingly revealed portrait of human nature and the male side of it, that's really something to be frightened about.
Brian, you're making a very good point, and I really want your thoughts about this. So I sometimes wonder if pornography is the way it is because male sexuality is the way it is, and male desire and male economic power is what's behind it. So it's something like, is there something intrinsic to male sexuality that gives rise to this thing? What do you think?
I doubt very much that there's something just intrinsic as such to male sexuality. I mean, that means that men are more likely to want to sort of give up on real women. I'm not saying give up, but sort of have their... To me, it would be a bit like believing in original sin, to believe that our natural sex instincts go for eroticization of hierarchy and so on. I think that Brian's question, though, is a really... Brian's comment is a really terrific one. And I don't know whether his colleague or neighbor or whoever it was said this, but it sounds to me as though there are a couple of issues. One thing that is very clear and has been said by people working in the porn industry themselves is that there's a tendency for escalation. So there's a tendency for traditional sex to be counted as completely boring, and you move past that really soon. And the way that the internet is set up is that you're lured in through ever-expanding sites to more and more extreme sites.
I want to step back a second because I agree with you about that, but I don't want to let my fellow males off the hook too quickly. I was watching watching an old episode of Sex and the City the other night, and one of the characters said, "I wish I could go to bed like a man." That is, I wish I could go to bed without any worry about ongoing attachment and this, that, and the other thing. Get up the next morning and just be done with it, and you know. Now, that was a representation of male sex. Now, one of the things some guys think about sex with women is the problem is the women. If you could get the sex and, you know, and not have to deal with the emotional demands and all that sort of stuff. And pornography says not only can you get the sex without having to deal with the emotional demand, but the women will love it, right? You don't think that's a response to some facts about male sexuality?
Well, okay, so what you say resonates very much with interviews that I've seen with consumers of pornography. So I'm thinking of one who said, I don't see how any male who likes porn can think actual sex is better, at least if it involves all the crap that comes with having a real life female in your life. I mean, that gets that, you know, real life females are trouble. Real life females talk back. They don't always say they don't always say yes, yes, yes. They take more than the ideal porn time to reach orgasm. You know, there are lots of nuisance factors with real life females.
Well, I don't want to disagree with that, but I want to separate a couple of issues. First, our caller Brian made an empirical claim, which is that the women subordination pornography is becoming more common. In a sense, that's true because pornography is mushrooming at such a rate that every kind is becoming more common. But I doubt very, very much that proportionally that's true. We have an email that says, "What is the role of control? Who's making it for whom? Women making porn for women, men for men." It's kind of a succinct question, but I think the idea is there's lots of kinds of porn available now. Second point is, I think Ken made a good point, but I think you ought to separate this whole business about financial exploitation and control. That's a possible difference with men. I don't know. But another one that seems much more plausible is this kind of very visual sexuality and maybe a certain amount of objectification that's involved in ordinary sexuality as well as pornographic sexuality for men. I don't know empirically, but I wouldn't doubt that that's the case. You say it would be like original sin, but surely that's the most plausible part of Christianity, so we shouldn't just dismiss it.
Before this conversation moves on too far, I want to let Brian back in here. He called with a follow-up question. Brian, you there?
Oh, yeah. I'm
welcome back. What's your follow-up comment or question?
I'm glad my comments have stirred up so much conversation. I don't think pornography is necessarily about control of women so much as the degradation of women. I've tried entering softcore on the Internet a few times, and you just can't find anything that's softcore. It's all vile and revolting and disgusting, at least to my refined sensibilities. But I was going to say that part of it, I think, is that the need for stronger and stronger and stronger stimulus, which I'm sure you understand that idea completely.
Right.
Second is all of this controlling and degradation may be a true and increasingly unpleasant revelation of the male sex, with its need to control and go out and, you know, be the one who brings back the raw meat and have its claws drenched in blood all day.
Okay, Brian, thanks. We've got a caller with a somewhat different point of view. But I remind you, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. The number to call if you want to join this conversation is 1-800-525-9917. We've got Andre in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Andre.
Hi. Well, it seems to me that that there's lots of women who really enjoy bondage and being dominated. And there are definitely men who enjoy being dominated by women. There's a whole huge underground of dominatrixes and the people are dominant and so on. And I mean, it seems to me kind of ridiculous to say that these people are violating their own civil rights.
Well, Andre, that's an observation that some people often make in defense of pornography. Ray, what do you think of that kind of observation?
Famously, masochism is named after the Count Sacher Masoch, who liked being bound up and liked pain. I think it would be very strange to compare the games that the Count got up to, which, let's say, are parallel to the games that certain privileged men can get up to. It would be very strange to compare them with actual cases of sexual violence in which women are bound up against their wills because people's tastes have been formed and conditioned by pornography. The fact that it looks the same thing doesn't mean it's the same thing when you've got a background of asymmetry of power.
So, okay, so I'm not, that was a lot to parse there. But you think it's false that to say that women in these representations who are depicted as enjoying them, that's a kind of misrepresentation that's driven by all kinds of complex political stuff, right? Is that roughly?
Well, obviously there's a great market for presenting women as enjoying whatever it is that they do. Well, sometimes there's a market for presenting women as not enjoying what they
right.
do. That's a separate subcategory of pornography. But for most people, the women's enjoyment or the imagined woman's enjoyment is part of the pleasure of it. And so if a pornographer is marketing pornography, that is what they're going to be depicting.
Right.
And you can't assume from the content of it that the woman is enjoying it. She's being paid to look as if she is.
There you go. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing pornography with Ray Langton, author of Sexual Solipsism, Essays on Pornography and Objectification.
Coming up, what, if anything, is bad about pornography? Is pornography intrinsically bad or bad just because of its social consequences? Join us by calling toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917 or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
The debate about pornography continues when Philosophy Talk returns.
Is it erotic or is it pornographic? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Ray Langton, author of Sexual Solipsism.
So, Ray and Ken, I want to put out some what I regard as rather radical ideas here, but they're partly also in response to an interesting email we got from Tin Q, who makes some very good points that I'll just incorporate here. But look, I mean, suppose we start... say, look, let's not be self-deceptive. Women are a lot different than men, and men are a lot different than women. Value neutral. Women would really like to think of men as the way they're presented on a lot of soap operas, at least some men are presented, very, very nurturing, interested in them for their minds, focusing on their children and the wonderful life they'll have and so forth and so on. Well, some men are like that, but most aren't. Men really would like women to be like they are in a lot of pornography, just mad about sex, interested in the sexual act, and so forth and so on. Most women aren't like that. No doubt some of them are. Now, the fact that this mismatch occurs has led to an enormous amount of human grief and misery. Women and men link up early in life, and they don't get what they expected. The man doesn't get the sexual dynamo that he had in the back seat of the car. Once she's been married for a while and gotten pregnant and has kids, that all disappears. The woman doesn't get the sensitive guy that he pretended to be when they were dating. Now, maybe pornography is a great opportunity to come to a new way of looking at this. Encourage people. Look, don't. Just as you play video games and you kill a lot of people, but you don't think that life is really like that, take your sexual energy and pour it into pornography if you're a man, and soap operas if you're a woman, and put off these entangling relationships that ruin everybody's life. Pornography maybe is a great boon to mankind and womankind. What do you think of that?
It's a kind of catharsis. It's kind of fictive catharsis kind of thing. What do you think, Ray?
You don't really believe the catharsis theory of pornography, do you?
What you just articulated.
The catharsis theory is the theory... Well, I hope not. The catharsis theory is the theory that, you know, you've got all this violent energy sort of bottled up in you, and it's this kind of Freudian plumbing view. You know, it's all got to burst out somewhere, and so why not let it burst out in this sort of harmless avenue rather than on real people? So, you know, suppose you had a would-be violent murderer, let them indulge in murderous fantasies instead of murdering a real person. Instead of letting... men's violent and hierarchical desires loose.
Let me clarify. I don't equate men's interest in sex with violence. I'm sure that there's a subset where that's true. No, I just think it focuses on the sex acts, it focuses on the genitals, and so forth and so on. I think it's relatively harmless, but it becomes harmful when a real person is involved and you expect them to be like that.
I think the deep point in John, and I actually think there's something deep about it, is that there's a mismatch between male sexuality and female sexuality.
So
and let me finish. And real life... Mm-hmm. Real life is a complicated negotiation over that mismatch to find ways that we can go on mutually together. Real life is that. But there are other realms that are not real life where we don't have to carry on those same negotiations. Those are the worlds of fantasy and imagination where we can suspend the constraints that real life imposes on us.
Okay, so... Well, first of all, I just want to express skepticism about whether there are innate differences here. But let's just assume that, supposing you were right that there's this mismatch, your thought is that you can let all the differences out in the realm of fantasy and then come to engage with other real human beings with more realistic expectations. But the trouble is that if you're sexuality is shaped by your fantasy, you're going to be exacerbating the mismatch, not healing the mismatch.
Well,
that, I think, is one of the biggest problems in pornography at present. So part of the thing we've been talking about is the objectification. Another problem is just sort of the straight-out androcentrism of pornography.
I think it's a very good point. Those are very real dangers. But take Harlequin novels, right? They're really focused on what women seem to want. They don't appeal to men. I mean, I'm sure they appeal to some men and don't appeal to some women, but there's this tremendous market in Harlequin novels. And I think it's very bad if young women who read these novels then expect the men to be like the heroes they find in those novels. So that's a danger, and it's definitely a danger on the other side a real and present danger. One thing that I think would be good is if we get more and more virtual pornography where the pornography doesn't really involve real people that have to do these acts and get bound, if that's what's involved, just as most of the violent stuff that kids play in games doesn't involve real people. But I'll leave it at that.
Well, I don't share your optimism about virtual pornography, because while I agree that one important aspect of the whole question is what's being done with real people, the real actors, another important question is what's being done to the consumer and the people who hook up with the consumer. Virtual pornography solves the first of these problems, perhaps, but it doesn't solve... by the way, it depends on what sort of virtual pornography you're talking about, but it doesn't at all address the issue that you're interested in, which is how to reconnect. I mean, if you think that one of the important things about sex, one of the reasons that sex is so important to us is as a domain in which human beings can relate to each other in a special and intimate way, Harlequin novels might get in the way of that. Pornography gets in the way of that more because
keep going.
You're bursting to come in.
Yeah, well, because I think you're still not granting the background thought. I don't think you're giving any credence to the fact that men and women, for either cultural or biological reasons, are different.
Okay.
That they have lives together, they have to negotiate those differences. But that negotiating those differences is not extinguishing those differences. And the negotiation goes on in real life, but fantasy and fiction, that's a different realm. And guys don't want to negotiate with women in the realm of their fantasies, and women don't want to negotiate with men in the realm of their fantasies. They want to have their fantasies. And now it's true that fantasy can configure real life, but there's two different sources of pressure. Real life is if men just had power to enslave and dominate women, that would be a really bad thing because they would run amok, right? And they have run amok at times. But when power relations are roughly relations are roughly equal, then I'm not so sure that you have to restrict men's fantasies in order to make real life more mutual and reciprocal. I'm just not so sure of that.
Okay. Well, one thing that persuaded me about this was reading a number of interviews with men who were consuming pornography that were collected together by Pamela Paul. So that she's a journalist who wrote a book called Pornified. And from the from the consumer's own experience, what they were doing in their pornography became part and parcel of what they were doing with women. So, you know, they sort of start off treating the pornography as if it's a kind of pretend woman, but they end up treating the woman as if she is pretend pornography. So there was one who said, when he was having sex with his wife, all the while I was thinking either about porn or trying to make her say things she didn't want to say. I was really just using her like a masturbatory accessory. And that is lonely and that is alienating. And a woman said about her husband, in a similar context, you know, I obviously knew where his body was, but where was his mind? He would sort of be there at first, and then I didn't know where he went.
Okay,
I realized I was just a tool. I could have been anything or anybody.
A guy
so the whole
like
thing
that.
Is invading his imagination and alienating the relationship.
A guy like that is not subject to the real-world pressure from real-world women. If I were a woman with such a guy, I'd say, look, you schmuck, I want you with me. I don't want you in your fantasy, and if you can't be with me, I'm gone. Now, in an era in which women couldn't do that without being murdered or raped, I would say you're exactly right. But in an era in which women can walk away, where there's the real-world market of romantic entanglements, walk away from such a guy. I mean, men don't have the power to make women stay in dysfunctional relationships anymore, do they?
I just want to interject. We've got a lot of email. We won't be able to read it all. A couple of continuing themes. That there's a lot of pornography made for women by women, that some women enjoy even the pornography made by men for men, that we ought to be paying more attention to what actors and actresses involved in pornography think about it. There's a pretty active discussion about whether we're being willfully ignorant of the utterly obvious, crucial, and intrinsic differences between men and women or not.
Yeah. We've got a call. Time for one last caller. Vernon in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Vernon.
I think that women, to some degree, all of the women, objectify men to a certain extent. They want them to behave certain ways and stay within certain limits and serve them in certain ways and not in others. And I think a lot of men end up rebelling against it in some ways and chafing against those limitations. And, that don't have to do with their real selves, but are the result of some kind of notion of men that women stick to, or they've been raised with, and so I think it's not just a one way street; it's really a two way street.
Okay, Vernon, thanks. Ray, I'm giving you the last chance to respond to a lot of stuff has come in the last few minutes. Respond to whatever you want to respond to as a wrap up.
I mean, I guess what I would want to say. Is that when we're thinking about fantasy, we need to think about how fantasy is, at least sometimes, to a certain degree, practice for the real world. And if people don't want their imaginations scripted by outsiders, they shouldn't. I mean, it's a good idea if they, for the sake of their own sexual autonomy, as anything else. To steer clear of that sort of porn.
Yeah, that's a good thought, Ray. And on that good note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Ray Langton. She's professor of philosophy from MIT. She's author of Sexual Solipsism, Philosophical Essays on Pornography and Objectification. So, John, you got any final thoughts? You had some intense thoughts there.
Well, actually, this ties into a dark side of my views about human life. I think there are big differences between men and women. I think men are a kind of an evolutionary holdover that isn't doing the world a lot of good.
You say that a lot. You really do believe that, don't you?
I really do believe that. I mean, if you look at the prison populations, who commits violence, so forth and so on, it's overwhelmingly men. Maybe it's just bad education. It could all be cured up by better elementary schools, but I doubt it. But given that we're not going to get rid of men, we got to figure out what to do about them. And I think one of the bad reactions to pornography is just women don't want to know the truth about men's internal life.
There you go. You know, I've done a blog on this. You can check out our blog at philosophytalk.com. theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo plago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we're going to turn to our own smutmonger, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, pornography has been with us since civilization was knee-high to a grasshopper. But it was not until the rise of the printed word, enhanced books, magazines, the postal service, photography, movies, and finally video cassettes, DVDs, and the internet, that porn was put right in the laps, as it were, of pretty much anybody who wants it. Not only that, in this new YouTube world, consumers have become producers. Many disapprove of pornography on various grounds, but somehow that has not stopped porn from proliferating. The exact effect porn has on society is still and will always be debated, but I noticed an article recently about a rise in the occurrence of women having cosmetic surgery on their labia, so they will conform to some aesthetic ideal of what labia are supposed to look like. Well, where would this ideal come from, except from mainstream porn? With its shaved bodies and heart-shaped pubic hair, ditto breast enlargement and Botox, the faux youthful yet trashed image evoked by these enhancements sure seem porny to me. On the other hand, much attention has been focused on mainstream porn, with its outlandish and cartoony caricatures of women with big hair, outsized fingernails, and breasts that could kill you if dropped from a great height. But there is another porn. In fact, many porns. The other day I spotted in a news group, for instance, this. Any girls on here who enjoy crushing toy cars with high heel shoes? In this simple query, you see the whole power and glory of the internet. Here is a guy, I assume, who before the rise of the internet would be forced to keep such a niche fantasy to himself. Well, they could share it, I suppose, but would be greeted, I would think, quizzically, especially by collectors of toy cars. But on the internet, surely he will find some girl who, yes, does enjoy crushing toy cars with high heel shoes and enjoys being watched while she does it. What is out there? Well, here's a brief list off the top of my head. Webcams, phone sex, furries, that is, people who like to dress up like animals, so-called slash fiction, in which amateurs create their own written porn about characters from Star Trek and Harry Potter, Japanese schoolgirls who suddenly sprout penises, Japanese schoolgirls having sex with tentacled aliens from outer space, office sex, bondage and discipline, spanking, giant women, shrinking women, superheroines in distress, The Simpsons in incestuous orgies, clothes sex, clothed female naked male sex, sex in public, mind control, hypnotized sex, ravished brides, humiliation, naughty nurses, exhibitionist housewives, sex in public, orgies, drunken party sex, voyeurs, goth girl sex, celebrity sex, fake celebrity sex, hot girl-on-girl action, barely legal sex, mature sex, vampire sex, robot sex, and fetishes as numberless as the stars. Me, I like my porn the way I like my coffee, tepid in a cardboard cup. And yeah, there's an app for that. I gotta go.
The tongue-twisting wisdom of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.